I don't know, most kids say they love music, but I really did love music. And I remember him absolutely slating my presentation, so telling me I was terrible. Somebody from the BBC stood up and said, "You're nothing better than a baked bean salesman."
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who've made a difference. Phil Riley.
I can recall Christmas Day 64, 65, actually being bought a radio for Christmas. It was a really vivid memory of waking up and there's a radio in the corner of the bedroom. I then remember building radios, Vero boards and soldering irons and stuff. Clearly, I remember Luxembourg in the early 70s.
And at the time, just before 1 o'clock, here is indeed the news headlines. Britain is to get the new Leyland Mini, provided real progress.
I've got memories of listening under the bedclothes to football commentary. Not too much BBC, although I do remember an Easter weekend with my uncle driving around. He was a lorry driver and I just got lumbered with him one weekend, or he got lumbered with me, and listening to Radio 1 play the all-time top 500 in the early days when stations used to do this, and all the top five songs were by the Beatles, and I just missed the Beatles because I was 6-7 when they were at the peak and I didn't really register, but this registered with me, and the fact that Tony Blackburn counted down this chart and all of that coalesced, I think, into being particularly gripped by radio when the commercial stations launched. So I missed the pirates, but I was 13 when Piccadilly launched in Manchester, Capital launched in London, and that was the time for me when I thought, wow, gosh, isn't radio exciting? And I just became more and more enamoured with it. When I decided to go to university, every single one of the five universities on my list of places to go had a student radio station. And that was the secret. I didn't even tell my parents. That was the secret filter on my list. And I ended up going to Loughborough, which had University Radio Loughborough. And that was the making of me, I think, as somebody that was going to have a career in broadcasting. I walked in, of course, like most university radio stations then. Oh, I'm sure it's still true today. If you walk in and show willing, you end up doing an awful lot. And I did shows. I helped run the newsroom for a bit. But I ended up being the programme controller in my second year and the station manager in my third year. So I'd already marked out that management was probably where I was heading rather than necessarily being on air. But I spent more time at University Radio Loughborough than I did on my course, probably. So that's probably why I didn't get a first.
Had you made your mind up by that stage that it would likely be your career?
I desperately wanted to do it. But like a lot of people who were in that environment, you want to do it, but you're not certain. And it was tough to get in. I was the same era as Paul Fairburn. Liz Green was at Radio Loughborough, who's gone on to be in BBC local radio. There were others that just came a bit after me. And it was to Steve King, of course, one of the big guys inside Bauer, was on University Radio Loughborough at the same time as I was. We all had an ambition to get into radio, but you couldn't guarantee it. And I was very, very fortunate to apply for a graduate traineeship at BR&B in the days when, this will amuse younger listeners, these were in the days when if you made profits as a radio station and you made too much profit, you had to do something with it, or the IBA just took it off you. So BR&B said, well, we'll invest our excess profits in training and we'll have these traineeships. And they had four of them, two in journalism, two in presentation and production. And I applied for them in my final year at university and was extremely fortunate to get one. I think somebody said to me afterwards that there were 600 or 700 people applied for these jobs, and there were two or four if you count the journalism ones, and I was lucky enough to get one. So I was very fortunate. The day I went for my first interview at BR&B, I can remember coming into New Street Station, getting a taxi to Radio House, getting out of the taxi and being absolutely overwhelmed by the smell of HP sauce. I've been absolutely overwhelmed by it because the HP sauce works were literally the other side of the road from the building.
So you walked through the door at BR&B in the heady days of the 80s. What was it like inside then?
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Well, incredible people. If I go through the schedule, You had people like Les Ross at Breakfast, just a genius. And anybody who was fortunate enough to be with Les in the 80s will know just how privileged you were to be around the same time as he was around. In much the same way as recently we've just seen this outpouring of warmth for Terry Wogan, of being such a gifted broadcaster. Les was the same, just an absolutely gifted person. Tragically never got onto the national stage, but for people who lived in and around the West Midlands, a fabulous guy.
And I went out and I didn't vote all day. I thought I was a bit frightened, even though I was now old enough. Yeah. I thought, only grown-ups do that. But anyway, I popped over the road and I voted Liberal. Voted Liberal because I liked the look of Jeremy Thorpe. Mm. I liked the cut of his jib.
Then you had Brendan Kearney, who did mid-mornings, and then Nick Meanwell was on there. Nicky Steele, I mentioned, who was the DJ of Birmingham, the guy that did all the big nightclub work as well as being an on-air personality. You had Robin Valk doing this sort of late-night rock show, a legendary. Every city had their own rock guy, and Robin was the rock guy for Birmingham. News was very important. Martin Campbell was the main phone-in news host. Martin went on to be a big wig at the Radio Authority. Brian Shepherd was the news editor, a great character.
The time is now almost 5 minutes past six. Brian Shepherd, BRMB, Sound News.
Sport was Butler and Tom Ross, still kicking today.
Absolute disaster! Disaster!
Butler was the head of sport, and what a character.
Now let's go to Everton.
Ed Doolan was that Mr. Opinion, Mr. Talk, that again, all radio stations had to have some guy that did the talky bit, and Ed was the guy.
Let's go to the telephone lines and to Chris, who has a riddle for us. Yes, Chris?
Fabulous. And every radio station, of course, whether you were at Metro in Newcastle, would have had the same. Hallam in Sheffield, Piccadilly in Manchester, Capital and LBC, slightly different. But all of those stations all had that same mix of big personalities. And it was great to be around. It was an entirely different era to the one that we were in today.
And in those early days, what were you doing?
Well, I had a year as a trainee, which involved lots of sitting at the back of the studio watching people do things and trying to learn by osmosis, doing editing and scripting and a bit of interviewing occasionally, just learning the trade, finding out how the business worked. We had 3 months, I think, at the National Broadcasting School, which is just off Dean Street in Soho. At the time, that lasted a few years, I think, the MBS. We were one of the first groups of students to go through there. And plenty of time practicing. In fact, at one point, we had a training weekend at, I think it was BFBS in Watford. And Tim Blackmore, who many people will know, a great doyen of the radio industry, had been drafted in to listen to us. And I remember him absolutely slating my presentation, started telling me I was terrible. And he was quite right, and he picked me up on lots of things. But, I mean, that was a quality of the training that you were getting from really great people. Paul Brown was my boss at the time. Again, another person who went on to do great things and be a very senior person within the industry. So I got great training from lots of people. Towards the end of my year, I was given one or two overnight shows. And Bob Hopton, Bob Hopton, who died earlier this year, gave me a overnight and then another overnight. And I was pretty awful. In fact, that tape does exist somewhere, and it's pretty grim.
Good morning. My name is Phil Riley. I'm new, but don't let that put you off. Thank you to Marie for the news, and thank you as well to Mike Hollis for the last 3 hours on the night shift. This is Dawn Flight, with all the usual things.
But I managed to get through it, and my big break was actually due to Roger Day's dental appointment. Roger Day had gone into Bob, who was the programme director, to say, Bob, I need next Thursday off. I've got to go to the dentist. That's the only appointment I can get. And Bob would have gone, yeah, right, Vicar, I'll sort that out. And he'd obviously made a note of it and then forgot to tell Katie or whoever was organising the rota for that day. And at 3:45, Roger was on at 4 o'clock, at 3:45, Roger hadn't turned up, and somebody had obviously gone in and said, you know, Roger's gone to the dentist, he's not turning up. Somebody then opened Bob's door and said, Bob, we've got a bit of a problem, Roger's not here, there's no one else around, whoever was on 3:45 can't carry on. Bob uttered an expletive And he rushed out of his office, and I just literally happened to be walking down the corridor, and it was, "Phil, you're on." And it was, and I was just thrown into the deep end. I mean, drive time on BR&B for a 21-year-old was like, oh my God. And I got my ads and got the logs and grabbed some records and ran into the studio and sat down and did what was probably a terrible show, but I got through it and people heard me, because no one heard you when you were on overnights particularly, but people heard me on the drive time show. And a few weeks after that, Bob called me into the office and said, I'm going to change the schedule around. I want you to do mid-afternoons. And so I started an on-air career for a couple of years. And then I realised it wasn't that I wasn't great on the air. It's just, there were people around me who clearly were much better than me. And so I knew that I was never going to maximise my potential as an on-air presenter. But I really did think, actually, I'm quite good maybe at organising other people and helping other people get the best out of themselves. And an opportunity arose to become the talks producer for the station. And I said to Bob, yeah, that's really what I want to do. I think I could have a good job at that and climb the greasy pole. And he gave me that opportunity. I still stayed on air. I was doing Sunday nights and Friday nights and Saturday mornings. Those are the days when you still had to pull a shift every day or two to keep the station on the air. So I never stopped being on the air, but I spent much more of my time making documentaries, making features, organising events. We did the first ever sports forums. I was the guy in charge of that, and that was a particularly great bit of experience, putting big name sports stars, football managers in front of a live audience and broadcasting it live. And that was fantastic. Butler and Tom were both involved in doing that. Great experience.
So how from there to management?
Well, I got to the point in about 1986 when I was on this greasy pole, but I was a long way down the greasy pole. And these were the days when there were a lot of people in management inside the programme department of a radio station. You had the programme director, he might have had a deputy, there'd be a news editor too, there might be a community affairs manager, a head of music, a talks producer, somebody else. There might be five or six people, and you thought, crikey, that's a long way to get to that sort of corner office and the programmer's desk. And I'd got friends who'd gone off and done other things, and I'd got a friend who'd gone off and done an MBA and was earning a fortune in the city, and I thought, well, that sounds interesting. Maybe I should just go off and do something else and just take a break. Because radio didn't pay very well. Not that it pays fantastically well now, I know, but it really wasn't well paid in those days. And I was fortunate enough to get accepted onto a couple of MBA courses and ended up choosing, I was very lucky to get some scholarships and went to Columbia in New York, fully intending not to come back into radio, fully intending to go to New York, get an MBA, probably end up on Wall Street or something, doing something different. And whilst I was in New York, I was suddenly exposed to American radio in a way I'd never been exposed to other radio before. And I was bowled over. This is when Howard Stern was just starting. Scott Shannon was on, just launched, I think, Z100 when I was out there.
Ladies and gentlemen, join us in a New York radio tradition.
So there was a real buzz. There was lots of competition. It was great atmosphere. And by the end of that period, by the end of my MBA, I thought, gosh, I haven't lost the bug. I really still want to be in radio. And it was just at the time, this is now 1988, just at the time in the UK when we were talking about splitting frequencies and potentially new stations on FM, and there was the rise of independent production companies just starting. And I came back and I spent 6 months trying to start my own production company, which didn't quite work. But at the end of it, Ian Rufus, who was the then MD of BR&B, said, we're about to split frequencies. We want to put something new on AM. We own BR&B and Mercia, so we want to put something new on AM across both of them. Do you fancy running it for us? And that was just a great opportunity. And I took it and we launched Extra. I think it was April 89. And that was fantastic. And that was a huge success.
Hi, I'm Phil Riley. Stay tuned at this frequency because something extra is happening at 8 o'clock this morning.
And that was Les coming back onto breakfasts on AM rather than FM. We just
How did you get him across on AM?
Well, I think at the time there was a view within BRNB that they needed, if we were going to split, then BRNB needed to be younger and more contemporary. And perhaps Les wasn't the best person to do that. So there was a talk about Les stepping away and going to mid-mornings or doing something, not breakfast. And I said to Ian, that's just crazy. This guy's a breakfast guy, and it's madness to use him anywhere else. And I agree, he would suit an older format better. So let's put him on the older format and put somebody else on FM. And that was the logic, and everybody bought into that. And we put Les on AM, and it was a fantastic success. And the Extra was just a great radio station, great launch, and some of the best times I think I had in radio.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 4th of April, 1989. I'm Les Ross. Welcome to XTRA Extra AM. Now, that's the cue for the champagne corks to pop in the boardroom. Go, well, they've stopped listening.
These were the times when radio was starting to get a little bit more scientific, analytical, and very much more of the stuff that you're very keen on. And you were using research in its early days, weren't you? And computerised music programming in its early days?
That's right. Well, Rachel Steele, the doyen of radio researchers, I think, and I got together and did music testing. And I think I'd seen some music testing in the States, but I don't think it had ever been done in the UK. And Rachel and I did it. We did it at the Yew Tree Pub in Yardley on the corner. And we got a bunch of people upstairs with a pen and a piece of paper and a tape machine and played them the hooks of Elvis songs and Cliff songs, because we were testing oldies, essentially, for an older formatted station, and asked them to give them a mark out of 5. And we tabulated them all, and we had a playlist, and we knew which songs tested really well and which tested badly, and we just played the ones that tested well. And it was, fantastically successful. The two interesting things about that were, one was that I went and sold the research to Transworld Communications, who owned Piccadilly and Radio Air and Red Rose, which subsequently led to me getting a job there. But the other thing was, I remember being asked to speak about music research at a radio conference, and somebody from the BBC stood up and said, "You're nothing better than a baked bean salesman," or something terribly derogatory like that. And I thought, well, no, not really. I just wanted to know what our listeners liked and didn't like about the music we played. And I wanted to give them more of what they liked and less of what they didn't like. And it seemed to work. And that was the start of music scheduling.
During your time in Birmingham, it's probably worth mentioning too that you met your wife at BRNB. Was this a secret office romance?
We were friends for quite some time whilst we each had different boyfriends, girlfriends. And then we ended up becoming romantically entwined not long before I then left for America. So I was a bit... it was a bit of a bad thing for me to do, but so that was 1986. So we're celebrating 30 years of being together this year.
So from Birmingham, where next?
Birmingham was interesting because at the time BRNB was part of Midlands Radio, and there'd just been a merger with Trent. So there was Trent and Mercia and BRNB. And although I was running Extra, and then I got the gig being the programme director for BRNB as well, I wasn't at board level, I was just a group programmer. And I did think maybe I should be aspiring to the next level. And there wasn't a general management role going inside Midlands Radio. And I got a phone call from Julian Allett, who was Owen Oyston's number two inside Transworld, who said there might be a potential opening for an MD at Radio Air in Leeds. Do you fancy that? And I thought, well, that's interesting. I can't say Jean, my wife-to-be, a Brummie, thought Leeds was a great place to go. But I went up and I thought, yeah, this is an interesting opportunity.
Stereo FM 94.6.
I mean, it was a heck of a challenge, Radio Air, because it was in the newspapers, it was known as Troubled Radio Air. It was definitely one of those stations. It launched in 84, 85 on a with an underpowered transmitter. And I'm not even sure it's ever managed to get beyond that underpower transmitter. And Leeds is a peculiar topographical place. It's in a dip. So the transmitter, while it was okay in Leeds itself, struggled to get very far outside Leeds, which was one of the reasons why the station had never really been a powerhouse. So I recognised it was a challenge, and I went there, and of course it coincided with a monumental recession. 1990-91 into 92 was awful, and that was no time to be running a business entirely dependent upon the buoyancy of the economy in order to succeed. And we lost a lot of money in 1990 and more money in 1991. And I was, you know, trying to turn the station around and launch another station with all the extra cost involved in a time of great recession. So I learnt a great deal, I think, about management and managing people and trying to manage a business. I don't think I got it all right at all. In fact, I was probably got more wrong than right, because I was only 30, 31. But it was a learning experience.
What did you get wrong?
I probably spent too much time focusing on just on the money, maybe not enough time focusing on the station. I probably thought, because I came from a programming background, that would sort, you know, be okay. So I spent more time sitting there worrying about where the next pound note was going to come in. So that was one aspect. It was quite a political atmosphere too. It was Transworld. Owen was an odd owner. So there was a lot of driving backwards and forwards across the Pennines to try and help keep everything going. But we made a profit in 93. We were on course to make a bumper profit in 94. So perhaps I did get more right than wrong, because we definitely came out at the end of it. And I think I left it in a much better shape than I found it.
For the second time, you were launching an AM split station, and in that case, it was what was to become a familiar name, Magic.
Yeah. Magic was just, it was the name left on the table after we'd eliminated all the other names. We just thought, well, Magic's quite good. And that definitely was launched on a shoestring. I mean, it was, we've got a team of presenters on Radio Air, and it was, well, we're going to use the same team, but we're just going to do two radio stations out of the one. I think Peter Tate was on Breakfast, and Ray Stroud. It was a pretty good lineup, and I think we probably did a slightly better job there of taking the presentation team and saying, look, you guys do FM, you guys do AM, and we'll manage it.
So that's the song that starts Magic 828. It's the Beatles and Magical Mystery Tour. We've just popped the champagne cork.
And again, Magic 828 was a great frequency. So Magic, again, launched and ended up, as was the case in Birmingham, where Extra beat BR&B in the ratings, Magic was beating Air FM in the ratings. But overall, the overall numbers were very good. So that was a great launch. And, you know, Magic's gone on. Obviously, it's transformed into a different thing. But nice to look at a brand that's still around today and think, well, I was the first guy to use that.
Magic 828, the 60s.
Well, I was at Radio Air, and we were doing okay, and we'd come out of that horrible early 90s recession, and the radio authority, as was, decided that there was sufficient capacity within the spectrum to launch some new radio stations. We'd had Classic, I think, Virgin, and what was then Talk Radio, and there was still sufficient capacity to launch some regional stations. And so they advertised, must have been 92, 93, bunch of regionals, and then they were awarded, and they all went on air within 5 or 6 days of each other. That was part of the nervousness of the existing radio stations, was, crikey, let's push these stations back as far as we can. So they all had to wait until the last one had been awarded. There were an original five. So it was Jazz in the Northwest, it was Scott FM in Scotland, Century in the Northeast, Galaxy in the Southwest, which had been a pirate and got bumped up to a regional, and then this new station in the West Midlands, which potentially had the best shot of all, I think, because it was a music station. It was a billed as an adult contemporary music station, although the music in the schedule in the application was a bit all over the place for adult contemporary. I think Dean Martin was listed in there. I don't think Dean Martin ever made it on air.
Everybody loves somebody sometimes.
But it was quite an interesting application. Chrysalis made it, and the guy that had masterminded it, Richard Huntingford, after they'd won it, thought, better go and find somebody that knows how to run radio stations. And I don't think I was the first person he approached, but I was the first person who accepted. And it was lucky for me. It was a great format. It was a great company. The station was in a market I knew well. I'd got a chance to come and start something from the ground up. That was really fantastic. That was a great opportunity to build something from scratch.
Day one of Heart in the West Midlands, I gather, wasn't without its technical challenges.
Oh, my God. I certainly spent a lot of my early career trying new things, whether it was music research or computerised scheduling. And for Heart, we decided to go for an automation system. And although we weren't the first, I think Mike Powell at County Sound was the very first, we were certainly one of the first, and we put this computerized system in place. It was an RCS master control hard disk system, and it kept crashing, and we couldn't understand why it kept crashing. And every two or three days it would just fall over on us. We were doing the final set of dry runs on a Friday, and it was about 5:30, 6 o'clock, and we were all ready to pack up and go home, and Nick was just finishing off his dry run show, and it collapsed. And we actually had to call somebody from RCS in New York to fly out over the weekend to try and get the thing. I mean, it massively corrupted the hard disk. And this guy flew out, and he arrived on the Sunday morning, and he spent the next 24 hours with his head in a racks unit trying to figure it out. And we just about got it back on air for Tuesday. And we launched, and we ran till about 12:30, by which time all the dignitaries and all the VIPs and everybody had gone. And at 12:30 on the day of launch, it crashed again, and we had to go back to playing CDs. And I think we were playing ads in off mini disc. I mean, that was the technology of the day. I think as I've gotten older, I've gotten less inclined to try and push the boundaries for a launch.
And the format and the music of Heart, as you say, it's not the Heart that we have now. How did it evolve in the early days as a brand?
I probably got that wrong at the start. I was pitching it as a soft rock format. I thought that's where the gap was. So, you know, Eagles, James Taylor, that type of stuff. And although we did okay, it probably wasn't as mainstream as it could have been. So I think it evolved into more of a mainstream format and slightly more up tempo. But it was probably a bit too medium tempo when it started. But that was where we thought the gap was. And certainly, we were still competing against the giants of Radio 1 and Radio 2, as well as the BR&Bs of this world. But there was probably a bigger, more mainstream gap. But at the time, of course, we were heavily circumscribed by the format that we had. And so you couldn't really go hell for leather to go straight after the incumbent heritage ILR. You had to be perceived to be doing something different. And it took probably three or four iterations of going back to the authority and saying, look, we really should. Can we change this slightly? Can we move that? Can we alter this? For those of us, me, John Myers, the guys that were involved in running those big regionals in the 90s, it was a constantly evolving practice of how much more can we just push back against some of the restrictions that we were operating under.
You're listening to Test Transmissions from Heart FM, the new soft rock station for Warwickshire and the West Midlands.
It was the start of what was a fantastic 13-year period in my life. I joined Chrysalis April the 2nd, 1994, and we launched in September 94. So it was a massive six-month period of getting stuff sorted out and studios built, premises. We didn't have anything when I signed on, so it was all very, very quick to get it sorted. And we had this very tight window. We launched in September, and the London bids were due in September, with a decision in October or November. So I joined with the express intention of helping Richard get that London application over the line, launching the Midlands, and hopefully in the window between launch and the London decision, doing well enough with Hart in the Midlands that when the authority sat around deciding what to do in London, they thought, those guys have done okay in the Midlands. And that, luckily enough, we managed to launch well, and we got good press. We did a dipstick survey that gave us some pretty decent numbers, and there was a generally good vibe about the station, and that, I think, was the thing that I hope that carried us over the line in London. So we were lucky enough to then win the London licence, and then a year later launch Heart 106.2. So we had two big Heart stations within a year of each other.
8 minutes past seven on London's new Heart 106.2. Oh, we're still sipping the champagne. Outside the studio, there's a whole gang of people there sipping champagne at this time of the morning.
We'd hired Keith Pringle to be our programmer, and Keith, very gifted programmer, had an absolute fixation that we should call the station Mix, because that's what he wanted to do, was to have a mix of music, and it should do what it says on the tin. And, you know, there's certainly some compelling logic to that. But at the same time, we were building this brand in the West Midlands, and I really felt very strongly that we had the opportunity to build a brand, and that that brand could potentially take us a long way, and that we shouldn't throw that away by doing something else in London. And that was a big debate around the board table as we were getting ready for launch, and in the end I won that debate, and we called it Heart, and Heart is now the biggest commercial radio brand in the UK by some distance. So, you know, that was, I was glad I stuck to my guns on that.
Heart 106.2, London.
And we didn't get it all right, and we couldn't find a big radio talent for breakfast, so we started with a slightly quirky breakfast show. That didn't quite work, so we moved on and tried a different tack. We had David Prever doing breakfast for a while, and that was okay. And then we thought, well, maybe we should try and use a slightly bigger star. We got Jono, and can't get much bigger than Jono. Hello, Jono. And that worked. And then we thought, we'd try and move forward. So you were in the shop window, and everything you did was scrutinised. And the other thing was, of course, we were a public company, but the biggest shareholder was Chris Wright, and Chris had a view on most things in life, and he certainly had a view on, you know, what was going out on his radio station. So the traffic had to be right, the presenting team had to be right, the music had to be right. And if Chris didn't like a song, boy, you knew about it. So everything was in the shop window. But I remember the radar that we went to number one. I was on a beach in Mauritius. I know this sounds like one of those ridiculous stories, but, you know, we'd never been to Mauritius before. We went to Mauritius on holiday, and I got a phone call. I think it was Richard, who was the group chief executive at the time, called me to say, here are the radar numbers, or my radar team had called me and told me. And we'd gone to number one, but we'd beaten Capital. Unheard of. Never been done. I tried to get hold of Chris. Chris was in Australia. So I know this sounds, you know, showbiz. I was in Mauritius. Chris was in Australia. And, he was flying to Australia. It was another, like, 6 or 7 hours. I was so desperate to tell him, because I know it was going to mean so much to him. I just had to sit there for 6 or 7 hours thinking about making this phone call. And I remember making the phone call and telling him we'd gone to number one, and, you know, how thrilled he was and how thrilled we were. And it was a big thing, not to denigrate Capital at all, because, you know, they were a fine radio station, still are a fine radio station, but to eventually in London, the capital city with the small c, but eventually in London, to have a competitive radio market where there was another commercial station other than Capital that was number one in the market was a fantastic thing. It was great for everybody inside Chrysalis and everybody who was working on the station at the time. But it was one of those great moments in my career.
And then Chrysalis was to grow its wings in acquiring stations.
Yeah, so we moved into dance music. We bought Galaxy 101 in Bristol, and then bought the two KISS licences in the Northwest and Yorkshire, and rebranded them Galaxy. It was a difficult time to try and absorb the KISS brand. It just didn't, you know, in the circumstances at the time, it was not the right brand for us as a growing company. So we decided to go with Galaxy. That was difficult internally. I think many of the Star felt the Kiss was a great brand name, and of course it survives to this day and Galaxy doesn't, so maybe they were right, but at the time Galaxy was the right brand for us, and that was a difficult thing to do, but Galaxy went on to be very, very successful.
Locked into the brand new Galaxy 102 and 105. Welcome.
It was a great radio brand. We ended up having another Galaxy in Birmingham and one in the Northeast. Big license win that. So Galaxy was, you know, was a really strong brand for us and had some great talent on it over the years. Hursty is, you know, probably the shining example, but great talent all around the place on Galaxy. So that was fantastic. Then we got another Heart in the East Midlands when we bought the Century, branded it into Heart. The group was really on a roll. We were growing fast, and LBC as well. It was certainly a gamble, I think, because I don't think LBC, well, maybe a historian might prove me wrong, but I'm not sure it had ever made any money in its history. Maybe there were some years when it did make a bit of money, but it was certainly one of those stations that was more loss-making than profitable. And the deal was quite a complex one. This was a deal between Chrysalis and GWR, where we sold GWR Galaxy and they sold us LBC. I think we wrote them a cheque for the difference in the valuations. But essentially, we traded a station in Bristol. I have to be honest, Galaxy 101, it too had never made a lot of money. So from a financial perspective, it wasn't, although we were slightly diminishing the brand, we weren't diminishing our profitability, but we were getting two London FM licences. And my view, and I think Richard Huntington's view, was that's too big an opportunity to turn down. And we knew that as we took control of them, that we were going to be able to flip the formats. And that was the big thing. It was being able to put the talk station back on FM. And I thought there was a real opportunity there to do something with an FM talk format and really re-establish it as a major part of the commercial radio scene in London, and therefore make money out of selling what I hoped were going to be pretty big audiences. And certainly the first part was true. We definitely built a big audience out of the station on FM. The revenue was a bit slower to follow, and I think when we sold the company, I don't think the revenue had gotten to the point where it was making LBC very profitable. I'm sure they're doing better now. Within the bigger structure of global, LBC will be, I'm sure, doing well from a financial perspective. So I think it was a long-term play for value. You know, I think it was the right play. We had a terrible early radar. We just couldn't understand the numbers. And the reason we couldn't understand the numbers was radar had got them the wrong way around. And the AM was on FM and FM was on AM. And we're looking at these numbers thinking, this can't be quite right. And then we eventually realised that there'd been an adding up error and it got corrected.
And some of the presenters that were put in place in those early days, still there now?
Well, they are. And Nick Ferrari and James O'Brien, you know, the sort of two big shifts from 7 a.m. till midday, you know, 1 o'clock. You think, well, actually, you know, I had a hand in those guys being on that radio station. They're still there today. So I'll take a little tiny chink of its ongoing success. LBC was a fantastic radio station to be part of. The station flew once it was on FM, and Nick, as the flagship presenter, you know, is there to this day, and it's great to see him still doing well.
Are you losing London, Prime Minister?
5 million digital radios in the UK so far. So who's listening?
I bought one for my nan for Christmas, and
I set out with a different strategy, which is to pull the other regional players together, so Jazz FM and GMG, and said to these guys, let's create this bouquet of our services and go and bid for the regional licences when they come up. And we were fantastically successful. We won all five of the major regional licences. That was a great thing. We populated that regional multiplex with things like Jazz FM and Smooth and, you know, the Heart. Was a Galaxy everywhere. There were other stations that we did it. We did a cheap and cheerful rolling news service, for example, DNN. That was great fun, and the multiplexes were fully let, and I think they sort of washed their face. And the truth was, we were keeping the frequency warm, really, for a point in time when DAB began to make profits, which where it is now. Of course, the regionals have disappeared in favour of more spectrum, both for national and local, and that's just a planning decision, and that's fine. But you know, at the time, it was a great opportunity. And
were all of your management colleagues back then as confident in the success of digital radio?
No. We had Mark Flanagan, who was one of my senior guys, famously quoted in the press as saying, you know, commercial radio can see a turkey when it's staring one in the face, something like that. And Ralph Bernard, who was the big passionate champion of digital radio, never fails to mention the turkey quote to me. But I think Mark would probably say, well, it probably even to this day, digital has not made any money. So he probably still feels he would have won a bet had he taken one with Ralph at the time. But I think digital is here to stay and is probably a profitable part of most radio stations' business now, in the sense that the extra hours that most of the big groups are getting from digital probably are being converted into revenue at such a rate that it pays for the costs. So I think digital's, you know, in a much better place than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago when we were taking a punt.
So the enlarged Chrysalis Radio Group is then sold off and you walk away. How do you feel when you walk away from something you've created from the start?
Well, you feel awful on a personal level about, it's like putting your baby up for adoption, I suppose. You hope you're giving it to a good home, but you're walking away from it and you feel terrible. It was the right thing to do for those radio stations in order for them to grow. The circumstances of Chrysalis and Chris's position as the major shareholder, and quite understandably not wanting to dilute his shareholding, meant that we were never in a position to be able to become the number one or number two radio group in the UK. So if you can't be one or two, then you really should sell. I mean, that's the logic of a good bit of business logic. And I said to the board, I think we should be exiting the radio business. And the board saw the logic, and that's why we went through that process and eventually sold. And we sold in August 2007. I mean, you know, my timing was fantastic because the financial crash started a month or so later and rumbled on for a year after that. We sold them for what was a great price for us. But I think when you're sitting around this table with Ashley and you say, what was the best deal you ever did? I think he would say buying Chrysalis, because we sold some fantastic assets and some great brands, two of which, Heart and LBC, are still with us. And I think they probably were very exercised about losing the Galaxy brand too. I know, you know, even though they merged it with Capital in the end, I'm sure that they thought, gosh, there's a lot of value in the Galaxy brand as well. So it was a great business to sell. I did think, as we sold it, I thought, we're selling it to somebody who's got the ambition to take this on in a way that Chrysalis just wasn't able to do because of all the other surrounding competing elements of the Chrysalis business. So I was happy to do it, and corporately I could see it was a great thing, but personally it was a really sad thing because you've got people like Jamie Theakston doing Breakfast on Heart and Nick on LBC and Hursty and Ed James in Birmingham. You know, got a lot of great talent and fantastic sales team. Don Thompson running a great show there. You know, I'd set my sights on getting Don Thompson in as the commercial director almost from the get-go. And we decided we needed to be different to the other guys. And so we said, well, let's just take a different view and let's just run 12 ads an hour. But we'll call them units. And we'll say to clients, look, it's a unit. We're going to charge you a price for that unit. You can have 60 seconds if you want. You can have 30 seconds if that's all you want. But it's the same price. And we ran with that for quite some time. We obviously then modified it because we needed to do something different initially to get people's attention. But once you've got their attention and you can prove that advertising with you works, you can then fall back into a more sensible structure. I still to this day think that we tend to price our different unit lengths perhaps slightly oddly, but it's set in stone, really. It's one of those things where actually trying to unpick that's probably too much effort. But it was an unusual way of going about business, and it got us some attention, and that was what we were trying to do, to get people's attention, because we were new and people tend to not want to try new things. It was a really great operation, and it was tough to just sort of pack up my bags and drive up the M40, but you know, I did it, and I think I did right by the stations.
You put together a vehicle to acquire a number of stations which Global Radio had to sell, and that meant ultimately you were walking back through the door of BRMB. How was that?
Well, it was weird, although, of course, I was walking through a different door, because when I left BRMB and Extra in 89-90 to go to Radio Air, we were still in the old radio house. By the time I walked back in, we'd moved to these super swanky offices on Broad Street. So that sort of felt slightly odd, coming back into the same station but in a different building. So that was, in a way, that was actually quite good, really, because that did say to me, look, you need to think about this differently because you're coming into a different building. But it was still very odd to come back into a building as part owner when I'd left it just as another one of the guys who'd been working there.
If you were going to write a book about your life, it would probably be about radio. You have written one, and it's not.
No, it isn't. No, it's all about health and lifestyle and life expectancy. And its genesis is radio, because its genesis was a couple of things that happened to me in 2013, and one of which was the death of three good friends, former colleagues of mine, who all died in a very short space of time in 2013, all at around the same sort of age as me, mid-50s, late-50s, early-60s. And that, combined with one or two other things that had happened during that year, made me start to really think about life expectancy and lifestyle and what was going on. And I just, as a sort of side shoot to my normal working life, started to investigate all of that and got really interested in the science and the maths and the stats behind life expectancy, and ended up doing so much work that I got to the point of thinking, do you know what, there's a book in this. So I carried on writing and thinking about life expectancy and lifestyle, and that's the book I wrote. So the genesis is friends of mine passing away too young. The end result is a book which hopefully opens up a bit of a window for people on, here are the things that you should and shouldn't be doing, and here's... And then I tried to make it a business book in the end by saying, if you want to live a long, healthy life, here are the things you need to do, and here's the most efficient way of doing them. What would a businessman do if he was presented with this as a challenge in his business? Well, you'd look for the most efficient way of solving the problem. And that's what I've tried to do, is to say, OK, you've got to do A, B, C, D and E, but what's the most efficient way of doing that? What does the science tell us about how to the best way of being fit or eating healthily or whatever? And I've tried to pull that in a book, and I think it's got something to it, and it's going to be published in the spring.
If you were to plot the life expectancy of slender Phil Riley now, it would look okay. You weren't always that shape, were you?
I wasn't. I was in my early 40s, late 30s, early 40s. I was clinically obese. I had a body mass index of 33, and anything over 30 is clinically obese. So I really did need to lose some weight. People who knew me at the time will probably recall I was just, you know, a big guy carrying a lot of weight. And of course, when you do have a big frame, you can carry a lot of weight, and people don't perceive there to be anything particularly wrong with it. But actually, the more weight you're carrying, the worse it is for your health. And I decided to do something about it. I remember walking down a long corridor once, seeing this really big fat guy coming towards me, and as I got towards the end of the corridor, I realised it was a mirror, and that was really one of those, oh my God, I really do need to lose some weight. And, you know, got into being a bit fitter and healthier, although I don't think I'd cracked everything by the time I started to research this book. So there are still some things that I talk about in the book where I wasn't perfect when I started doing the book. There were still things I needed to do, and I, you know, learned the most effective, efficient way of doing them during the course of writing the book. It's called The Life of Riley, published by Columbus Publishing.
So looking back over, 40 years, just about, in radio of all forms, what would you have done differently?
A bit of me would still like to be on the air. A bit of me would still like to be in front of the microphone on a regular basis, talking to people. I probably will be a talk radio host rather than a music DJ. My music taste, I'm afraid, have atrophied. They've ossified into Bruce Springsteen and the Eagles and a bit of 60s Motown soul. I've probably not developed my musical tastes. But in terms of talk radio, I love talk radio, whether it's LBC or 5 Live or a bit of Radio 4. So I love listening to talk radio, and would think, gosh, maybe I should have stuck with that a bit, because I might have had something to say and something to add some value. So that's one thing I might have done a bit differently. I mean, is there anything else I'd have done differently? God, I wish we'd bought Magic back in 1995, I think it was, when we were just setting out as Chrysalis. We had an opportunity to buy it, and we were up against EMAP, called Melody then, and we didn't buy it, and they did, and they offered £1 million more than we did, or whatever the number was. And I look back at that and think that was a real missed opportunity. And there were a couple of occasions towards the end of our time at Chrysalis when we were heavily engaged in conversations with GMG. We could never get that deal over the line. John Myers and I tried, and the boards tried, but it just didn't quite come together. And that's frustrating, because you can see now inside Global, in many respects, what that deal would have been with the much bigger Heart network, Smooth network. Actually, that could have been Chrysalis and GMG if we'd have managed to get them together. So a couple of corporate deals that I missed, a couple of personal things I didn't do right. Hopefully, there'll be one or two people in the industry saying that Phil Riley, he didn't do right by me, but hopefully not too many. I would hope that most people that I've come across in the industry that have worked with me would say, yeah, he was a great guy to be part of the team with.
It would be nice if I could have a Card of the Day winner on my first ever show on BR&B, so if you're out there, give us a ring.
Well, I think I'm going to be remembered as the guy that launched Heart, simply because it's the biggest commercial station in the UK. It's only one of a number of launches, and an Extra was certainly a great launch, although it's gone now into the ether. I suspect Heart will always be the first thing on my obituary. It will say the guy that launched Heart in the UK. And that's not a bad thing to have on your obituary, is it?
Thank you.